Hello and welcome to the Oregon Wine History Archive podcast. The Oregon Wine History Archive is located at Linfield University in McMinnville, Oregon, and is dedicated to preserving and sharing the Oregon wine story. This podcast shares these stories through oral history interviews we've conducted throughout the industry. Please enjoy today's episode.
My name is Rich Schmidt. We're here with Marissa Kipp. It's February 28th, 2024. We're at Crew and Domain in Portland. And Marissa, thank you so much for joining us today. The first question, get you started, is why wine?
Why wine? Well, I grew up in a household that wasn't necessarily super wine-centric. My parents weren't collectors or anything like that. We had wine around, from, you know, around dinner. My mom or dad might have had a glass here and there. So it was never like a big driving factor. It was never something from a young age. I was like, oh, I'm absolutely going to be into wine. There's no family legacy of wine, so to speak. But when I had finished college, we just moved to the Seattle area, and I was looking for some kind of work. And luck would have it, I found a position posted online for a tasting room associate. And so, I have dabbled in the world of adult beverages before then. So I was like, sure, wine. I like wine. I could talk about wine. I could pour wine. So it was really the tasting room experience that was my first introduction into the bigger world of wine. I was working at a really great winery. I'm so fortunate to have gotten the start where I did. And great winemaker, great general manager. They're thriving now. They're really become part of like my extended family. I love them to pieces. And I'm so grateful that that particular winery, they had a lot of different types of wine. They sourced some varietals that were maybe a little less common to people, so not just Cab or Merlot or Pinot. And I would have people come into our tasting room that started asking bigger questions in the world of wine in terms of, you know, how does this relate to this grape where it's grown elsewhere? You know, I've never heard of this grape. What about the history of it? Where did it come from? And I'm that type of person where I was very quickly unhappy not knowing the answer to those. So I spent a lot of time kind of researching specifically the grapes and wines that we were representing in that tasting room. But that winemaker and the GM had also gone through the quartermaster sommeliers. They had both taken their introductory exams through the restaurant that they had been with. And so they saw, you know, the value in having a semi-structured environment to learn a little bit more about wine. And the restaurant group that they had been with had asked that winemaker, hey, would you organize an introductory exam? We know you've taken it. Can you somehow organize this for our staff? And he said, I would be thrilled to, as long as I can put my employee in it as well. And they're like, of course, why not? So he let me know, hey, that wine test we had talked about before, I signed you up for it. And I was like, great, okay. When? He's like, oh, it's in like 8 weeks. I'm like, no, I need like a date. Like, please tell me when this is happening. I need to make this happen. And so, you know, fully dived into the theory side, you know, really a structured study regimen so that I could make sure I covered the biggest wine regions across the world and not just those that related to what we had in our tasting room. And from then on, I was kind of hooked. Mm-hmm. My competitive nature, where it's not competing against my peers, it's competing against myself in terms of like, how far can I take this? You know, how far can I go with it? How much can I learn? Obviously, it's impossible to learn it all. You know, I'm never striving for perfection, but just improvement.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're gonna pick it back up there in a second. Let's talk a little bit about life before wine. As you mentioned, not really growing up around it. So tell us about kind of where you're born and raised, early life, and sort of path up into college.
So I was born and raised in Camas, Washington, so technically across the river from Oregon, but if not for that river, it would be a suburb. And yeah, I stayed around town most of the time. I came into Portland a lot growing up, which I think helped lead me to appreciate the food side of, you know, wine and food together collectively. And yeah, it was basic. I mean, I have no complaints in terms of my upbringing where I grew up. And, you know, it's lovely to be, I still have family in the area. So that was a big determining factor to move back to town. So before my husband and I started having kids, we were like, yeah, definitely want to be close to family. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about college.
College, Washington State University, go Cougs. We can travel around the world and we still get go Cougs if we have like a hat or a sweater on. So that's a fun community to be a part of. I think it helps being in what is, you know, a small college town. There isn't a lot to do outside of town unless you really like to grow lentils and wheat. So everyone that goes to that school has a very common and shared experience. Mm-hmm. So that helps with the community of alumni.
Before the tasting room job, did you have an idea what you wanted to do with your life?
Not really. I've always been in hospitality or sales where I'm customer facing. I used to sell knives at one point. I also used to teach ballroom dance at another point. So varied background. And it wasn't really until I started in the tasting room and got into wine that I really felt like I had found my home. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned, obviously, you kind of got thrown in the deep end. You got a test coming up. You got to start learning about wine. Tell me about starting to learn wine at that level. What intrigued you about it? What kept you wanting to learn more? And what did you find were the most kind of interesting things you were learning at that point?
Well, it started with making sure I knew everything that we had at my particular winery. Like, I had every single thing that was on a technical sheet in my head. And then I started to ask the deeper questions of, okay, what does that mean? Like, great, if I can list off, you know, an oak regimen, let's say, for a given wine, what does that mean for the wine? So it kind of made me start questioning the how and the why behind wine, not just you should get this, you should get this, these are the tasting notes, the end. Mm-hmm. So I started getting a little more interested with the process, and being there at that winery, I got to, you know, see behind closed doors, peek behind the curtain, and, you know, watch a lot of the winemaking practices because it was on site there. So it was interesting to see what all was going into these bottles of wine and not just taking them at face value. You're like, great, it's grape juice, the end. Mm-hmm. And from there, again, just learning that there was so much more to the world of wine. Like, every time I came across a fact or had somebody ask me a question I didn't know, it made me dig a little deeper, maybe acquire a new book. Books are my love language, so I have a collection of books and also an ever-growing list of books I want to acquire. For that reason, I will always be a lifelong student, regardless of certifications or any of that. There's no end point for me. I will always keep learning. And as I learned more, I realized how much more there was to know. So yeah, it's endlessly fascinating. There's so many different aspects of wine that you can look into. And, you know, nerd out on any particular fact or region or grape and you name it.
So as you were customer facing and learning at the same time, tell me about sort of the confidence level or the communication level as people were asking the questions that before you couldn't answer. How did that progress? How did your kind of ability to converse and educate progress?
Well, it was a natural progression. Once I became more familiar with the information and the why and the how behind things, it became more of part of the fluid conversation I would have with guests or club members. And it's just, the better you know something, the more confident you are in talking about it. And one of the best ways to make sure that content is cemented in your memory is by teaching. So early on, even at that tasting room, as soon as my knowledge started to grow, I started teaching consumer classes and special events for our club members. And so having to take the information that I was learning and make it digestible for maybe someone who's not as deep into the studying side of things and make it understandable, but also engaging. And that got to, you know, tie into my history of sales being customer facing and, you know, just being able to be in front of people. And that is really the side of the industry that has drawn me the most. And so I've seen that thread continue as I've changed career paths and different facets in the industry, going from tasting room to other wineries to basically working every single position you can have front of house, starting at host, server, server assistant, manager, bar manager, bartender, general manager, beverage manager, you name it. So it's been a collective growth through the industry. As I've become more knowledgeable, I just have more opportunities to teach about more topics in wine.
So tell me about that first test. How did that go?
It went great. It was fabulous. I was fortunate enough to, have the mentality of always over-preparing for things, so I never feel prepared exactly, and ultimately it ends up meaning I'm over-prepared. So I have had a lot of success through my exams. I have passed the vast majority of them on first attempts. Mm-hmm. So lucky in that. The few no passes I have had have been that opportunity for learning and growth, and you still learn more in those instances. It's not always about, yay, I passed, let's move on. So mm-hmm. opportunities there.
So you mentioned all the places that have come since. So let's take a little bit of the career path journey mm-hmm. here. So tell us about sort of the next steps and the big steps along the way for you.
So a lot of that has been like moving back to the area to be close to family, and that was, you know, heartbreaking to have to leave my winery, my first home, so to speak, in the wine industry, and those people that really did become family. But there's, every time you move, you have a new position, there's that opportunity for growth. So everywhere I've been, I feel like I've picked up something. And I went from tasting rooms into restaurants, like I said, working in a number of different positions at a number of different restaurants with a number of different cuisines or styles. So there's always that, you know, what is the wine list here, or am I building the wine list here? I had trouble in this market finding mentors to help with the growth. So I learned a lot on my own, which is not always the smoothest or easiest path. And that was something that in this particular market, I was struggling for mentorship. So as part of my path now, as I have grown a little bit and had different experiences in the industry, I try and make myself available to be a mentor for those that want it, which is part of the benefit of being in this shop. We run blind tastings every week, so we get a lot of industry people that have upcoming exams, so they need to get their repetitions in, their practice through whatever program they're in. And so it's fun for me to be able to help guide people through that process, since I've also been through a number of those myself. And it's also fun to, you know, still have the exposure to consumers that are coming in that are new to wine and not as far into the studying side of things. So they have the opportunity to, you know, ask the questions they've been wanting, and we try and make it a really approachable and easygoing atmosphere so they don't feel uncomfortable asking those questions. I also get to teach the educational courses that we have here as well going. So those just started this year. It's a fun opportunity to take a little bit deeper dive into specific wine regions. For example, the last one I taught was just sparkling wines around the world. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't realize how you get bubbles in wine. So there was a little bit of the educational, like, this is how the bubbles are there. Now let's taste some bubbles and why they're different. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the. I'm curious, from going from tasting room to like a restaurant setting, that's a different kind of approach to selling wine, different kind of understanding. So tell me about selling wine in a restaurant space and all the different roles you've had. How did you find, what were the successful ways of selling wines in restaurants?
It's being able to connect with everyone that comes in at their given level. So there's plenty of wine enthusiasts that come in, and there's plenty of people that are just like, oh, I just need a glass of something. Which of these three or four options do I pick? So being able to find ways to talk about wine that are relatable for any given person at any given level. So it's something that has continued to evolve, and it's something we continue to see here, where we have plenty of, you know, unicorn collectible bottles that people have read about or heard about or fortunate to own. And then we have people that come in that have never been in the shop before, and they're like, I don't know, I just need a bottle of something for dinner tonight. So it's been the process of, how do we talk about wine in an approachable way? Tell me what kind of wines you've enjoyed in the past, and based on, you know, the three things you've told me, I can recommend these other three wines because of that. So also being able to relate styles of wine across the world, which is, again, going back to my very beginnings, why I started learning about wine in the first place, was to connect wines we had with wines around the world that they may be familiar with already, and just growing and expanding upon that.
Tell me about, you mentioned being a wine director. Mm-hmm. Tell me about building a wine list, and what's sort of the theory for you behind a wine list?
It depends entirely on the concept of the restaurant, because how you'd build out a wine list for like an Asian fusion restaurant would be vastly different than a French bistro or an Italian trattoria. So always taking a look at the major concept that you have behind the restaurant as well. The wine list that I had built from nothing was not truly my own. There was a lot of criteria that I had to hit from upper management. So if I was to build my own wine list from scratch, it would be a little bit different than that one that I had in my past. But again, everywhere you go, there's the opportunity for growth and for learning. So I have learned to make wine lists based on my studies. As I'm studying wine regions, you learn about producers that have helped shape the style of the wines or are the biggest producer or considered the best producer. And so throughout studying the wine regions of the world, you come across producers that you want to know more about, you want to hear their stories. And so we get the opportunity to put a wine list together and we want to feature those wines. So in any given wine region that you're looking at, there's always the top five, top 10 producers or more in some cases, like really well-known areas like Bordeaux or Burgundy. But there's always those top producers that everyone in the area looks to as like the model of what they expect the wines to be like. And that carries over to, you know, when we talk about blind tasting and getting ready for examinations, there's the classic wines that are considered examinable that fit the profile of what we expect. Classic wines from classic regions. So it's fun to include those because you have that metric of this is what this region should be like. And then, I mean, you always have that flexibility of, oh, I'm going to find somebody who doesn't quite fit the mold, the new up and comer on the scene who's still making delicious wines but doesn't do X, Y, or Z like this other producer does. So there's, when building the list at a restaurant or a wine shop, it's a balance between you want to have classics that are recognizable and you want to have the new up-and-comers who maybe represent a better value. And there's always a few things that as the sommelier you get to put on the list because you are thoroughly excited about, but that's where you can get into trouble too. It's not just all about what you as the sommelier wants. You need to keep your guests in mind. You want to make sure that your wine list is ultimately serving them and their experience with you.
So if you were able to build a list without restriction, how would you like to focus it?
Ooh, that's way too open-ended. One of everything. At least one of everything, maybe two of some things. But there's so many fun wines in the world. It's really hard to narrow it down without being like, oh, I don't know. If I was making an Italian wine list, it would be this versus a French wine list, it would be this. You can look at any Grand Award winning wine list in the world. And yeah, that would be similar to what mine look like, at least for all the major producers for any given region. Like they're the major ones for a reason. They have that history and consistency year over year of producing delicious wines. It might be that little 5%, 10% of esoteric, cool, random things that would be different.
So tell me about the wine education path for you after that sort of initial test. What caused you to keep going and what have been the steps sort of along the way for that?
I have built upon the wine knowledge again, tapping into my slightly competitive side where I'm like, oh, what else? What else can I do? How else can I grow? Can I push myself? Can I challenge myself? So I did a combination of paths. There's the two that we see most commonly, being the Quartermaster Sommeliers and then also the Wine and Spirits Education Trust, or WSET. And I kind of stair-stepped my exams between them. They're both covering the world of wine. They have different areas of focus. So they're not exactly the same material, but collectively, essentially, it's all the same thing. You're learning about the wines. You're learning different, maybe, grid systems for doing blind tasting, but you're still learning the same skills, and you're still evaluating wines. If you're using different words to do so for one over the other, okay. But it all kind of built on each other, so I took my introductory exam at the Quartermasters as the first one. I think I did my certified exam with them next, so technically the second level. Then I jumped over, did level 3 with WSET. I did the Certified Specialist of Wine exam with the Society of Wine Educators. And then advanced exam, WSET diploma, which I hold, and then pursuing the Master Sommelier exam for now. Next, I'll do Master of Wine, glutton for punishment. So again, it's not an end point. It's not great. I got this one certification that I was aiming for and that's it. So it's going to be something I continue to do for life. Again, the accumulation of books is big for me. So the more books I own, the greater measure of my own personal success, I see it. I have many leather-bound books.
Of the successes so far, is there one that you're proudest of? Is there an exam that you felt was a specific challenge or you did particularly well on?
Well, it's hard to measure exactly how well you did. If it's a pass or a no pass is kind of the line for sure. I would say the one I am most proud about would be my advanced exam with the Quartermaster Sommeliers. It was, the year was 2017. I had been waitlisted for the exam that year. I had taken the course the year previous, so you sign up for the exam hopefully the following year, and I was put on a waitlist, which ended up being a good thing. I was really hopeful to get, at that time they had three exams in a year. I was hopeful to get the first exam because it was here in Portland. I wouldn't have had to travel. And I was also 8.5 months pregnant. I was like, great, I would love to do service with the big pregnant belly and just make it work. It'd be great, fantastic. I didn't get into that exam, which was all right. I'm sure the stress at that point in pregnancy probably wouldn't have been great. The exam in the middle of the year had kind of come and gone. I had a newborn, didn't really think of it. Then I got a phone call later in the year that said, hey, you're off the wait list. We have a seat for you for the exam in November. Would you like it? I'm like, great, that's 7 weeks notice and I have a 5-month-old. Sure, why not? I had just hired a nanny for like 4 hours a week to like help with child. I was like, all right, well, hey, new nanny, how would you like to go full-time instead, starting like tomorrow? Turned out to be a really fortunate, you know, turn of events because she also became like part of our extended family, surrogate grandmother thrown in there. She really took to my daughter, and so she's still involved in our lives too, which is amazing. But 7 weeks notice where I was not currently working, thank goodness. Because adding that on there would also not have been a great thing. But I essentially stayed upstairs in my office studying as much as I could every single day. I would go downstairs to, you know, say hi when I needed my baby fix, feed her, because at that point she was still very attached, literally. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, 7 weeks notice, crammed for that exam, flew to St. Louis with my husband and my daughter, because she still very much needed me. And it was such a surreal experience to be in November in St. Louis, which is very cold, having to bundle up baby, bring her with, having to still kind of get your mind right for an exam setting. And at that point it was 3 days. So you had theory on one day, practical on another day, tasting on another day. And having to like coordinate, like, all right, I'm gonna feed baby and then I'm gonna go to the exam and then I'm gonna meet up with them afterwards. And I mean, chaos. But I managed to pass that exam on my first attempt, even in that set of circumstances. I would not recommend doing it that way. Would not repeat that exact experience. But it was so great, and it was so rewarding to have both my husband and my daughter there for the results. Mm-hmm. So there is a picture floating around somewhere. You know, every time at the end of an exam, they take a picture of who succeeded that particular attempt. So everyone holds their little diplomas, you have your new pins on, and I'm also holding my daughter in that picture. So there's a bunch of wine professionals and a little baby, and that one's mine.
Yeah, that's amazing. Very focused 7 weeks. That's impressive. Tell me about preparing for something like that or any of these kinds of exams. Obviously, a world of information. You have some idea what you're going to be quizzed on or tested on, but you don't have a real, you know, how do you go about trying to learn that, try to be able to recall that amount of information? And what have you found, I guess, what have you found are like the proper strategies for something like that?
Well, that varies wildly based on who you are as a person. We all have different learning styles too. So there's things that work for me that don't work for other people. For me, what has worked is drawing maps by hand, not tracing them, which means my maps are very ugly. Very, very ugly, especially at the start. Basically, if I can draw a map with just bubbles, like, all right, this region is kind of looking like this, and this is where this is. The main goal for me is not how pretty can I make my map be, how accurate can I be with the exact like designation of a line between appellations. It's more, do I know where everything is in relation to the things around it? So if it's not exact, okay. But if I know generally this region is east or west of this one, you have this major river, you have this mountain range, major cities. So if I can get that kind of rough idea, I've created a basic equivalent of Google Maps in my brain, where I can think of the country and then kind of zoom into the region I'm looking at or studying, or zoom in further than that. So it helps to have a geographical representation of knowledge. So I'm like, great, if I'm looking for this, I know I'm going here, and then I zoom in a little further and I know it's here. So it helps to not just have like lists or pages of information. If you can tie that to a physical location, it's easier for recall. That being said, there's still plenty of rote memorization. I have plenty of note cards that I go through very regularly. But again, going back to, you know, what my passion is too in the wine industry with teaching, if you can teach the material, ultimately you know it best. If you can't explain something to the point where my now almost 7-year-old would understand, that means you don't understand the information well enough yourself. You should be able to break things down into digestible pieces for anyone. And that has helped in my career, you know, being able to talk to consumers and then switching gears and also being able to talk to those going for higher level exams in the industry.
How have you felt your appreciation for wine as a consumer of wine change? Has it been easier? Has it been harder? Is it, when you know all this information, how does that affect your palate? How does that affect your enjoyment?
It affects my wallet. my husband has a distinct memory of back in college when, out of curiosity, not because I thought it was going to be good, but we were at the store and I was like, I want to know what that cheapest bottle of wine tastes like. It was not good. So it's one of those, like, I found as I've kind of passed certain thresholds and price point, like, it's hard to go back. Mm-hmm. So for those people that are like, I don't know, I really like this $9 bottle of wine. Great, buy all of it, drink all of it, continue to enjoy it for as long as you can. Because once you get past that, going back is a little more difficult. And all the wine things you learn and all of the knowledge I've accumulated for over a decade at this point easily, it's been boiled down to two things. There's two kinds of wine in the world, wine you like and wine you don't. And so I can drink cheaper bottles of wine and enjoy them and have, you know, styles that I'll gravitate towards. Like, absolutely, there's what I consider my Tuesday wines, the side of the cellar that I won't be mad at if somebody pulls a bottle from. Then there's the other side of that where it's like, I'm buying these for a reason because I know this producer, I know they make great wines. I'm buying them to lay them down and, you know, let them simmer for a little bit, and I'll revisit that in another couple of years. So it's been two separate paths where it's like, yeah, I can still have a glass of just about anything and enjoy it in the moment. But if I'm choosing to purchase my own wines, like, I've expanded my range, and I can see the value in buying bottles that are hard to find when I come across them.
Similar question about from sort of the knowledge education, the memorization education. I'm curious about the blind tasting education. Obviously, you mentioned that's something you have to practice often. Tell me about that, about kind of the steps of starting to understand, starting to be able to recognize. What have been sort of the keys for you along the way for that, and how do you keep it going? How do you keep it up?
So the accumulation of blind tasting, there are no shortcuts. It is just a matter of practice. For anyone that's like new into it, that's like, oh, what's the key to this or that? Like, practice. I have made more mistakes than I have had successes, and that will probably always be the case for many, many years yet to come. But it is the practice of it. So starting off in my early exam days, I was fortunate enough to have some good tasting groups, some good study buddies. Blind tasting really is just an extension of theory. Like, it's one thing to be able to list aromas or flavors that you get in a wine. It's the next step to be able to really accurately pinpoint the structure of a wine, which is really the fingerprint for each wine. Once you can accurately identify alcohol levels, acidity levels, tannin levels, or phenolic bitterness in wines, those are the things that are going to speak and let you call a wine accurately time after time, not just how any given wine is giving you, oh, this aroma or this aroma. If you start reading tasting notes for similar styles of wine, the tasting notes all really start to sound similar. So I like to say the structure doesn't lie. The structure will lead you down the correct path each time. So a combination of tasting many wines and also relying on the theory side, knowing the how and the why the wine is presenting this way, what goes into making a wine that makes the final product fit this fingerprint, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And tasting groups. It was great to have my little community. It's hard to keep tasting groups going, but we kind of have formed and fallen apart multiple times throughout the years. There's so many people I could look back on and think and be like, oh, you know, thank goodness we had this experience together, and it's helped calibrate how my blind tasting has gone. There are certain people that, you know, have went out of their way to help me prepare for exams, and I'm forever thankful for their contribution to my journey as well. And then how to keep it up, you have to keep practicing. If you don't use it, you lose it. And so, yes, with me continually having exams looming on the horizon means that I have to keep on it myself. But also being here at the shop is like one of the greatest opportunities for me and others in the industry to practice that skill. For what you would pay for any given bottle of wine to show up at your tasting group, instead you can come here and know that you'll have 6 wines presented to you that have all been vetted, that are all examinable, that fit the profile and are tasting as they should. I did not have something like that, so it was a little more work to keep a group together, a little bit like herding cats. So keeping blind tasting groups together is a lot of work. So it's nice to be able to provide a space for people to come and not have to worry about the extra part of it and just show up and get to practice that skill in particular.
So let's talk about this place. Obviously you mentioned you've worked a lot of places. Mm-hmm. Tell me about how you found your way here.
It was a fortuitous event. The stars aligned. I was post-COVID, we started forming a lot of more virtual study groups. So as I was preparing for Master Sommelier Theory, started meeting a lot more people virtually. And that's still true. I still have my tasting groups that are not tasting groups, but theory groups that get together, and we're spread all across the country. But with this particular group, we had been studying together for a while. And at one point, this guy named David was like, oh yeah, my hometown, Portland. And I was like, wait, that's my, what are you talking about? Like, we didn't even realize that we were in the same area for months, which is laughable now. But I mean, it speaks to the group, because we got on our calls and we got down to business. And we were studying wine. Didn't have all those other frills of friendship. What is that? But it was funny that's how it kind of came about. And he had mentioned on a call one time that he was looking for some help in the shop. And I was like, you know, I've never actually been in. I should go down and check it out. So we had talked about it. And they were looking for somebody. I was looking for a change. It helps to work days with now my 2 kids. So it was all the right pieces falling together. And now at this point, with both David and I preparing for Master Sommelier examinations, like, it's so nice to have a study buddy in house where we can quiz each other on theory on any given day. Like, great, I'll pull up my note card deck on this region. Let's talk about it. Or we get to intentionally study regions by picking a theme for, let's say, the wine flight for the week for our monthly events that we host. If we want to do a deep dive on things, we can make it happen in this environment.
So you mentioned all the kind of the roles you've played here, including education and all of that. Tell me about, introducing yourself to the shop and then also kind of making your mark here. What was your sort of introduction to this? And then what have you sort of added?
Well, I know that they've always wanted to have the education courses here. That's always been something that was a wish list item. And now the shop has hit 2 years. So they've been open for 2 years. I've been here for almost a year myself now. So it was one of the things where I knew I had the history of teaching classes and creating content for them. And it's always been my passion. I know it's always going to be what I end up doing in the wine industry. I will always be educating or mentoring or, you know, sharing my love of wine with everybody I can. So I kind of spearheaded the effort with, all right, let's get the classes off the ground. Let's do it. I'll commit to being the one leading the charge on that avenue, so to speak. The wine knowledge, it's great to have. I mean, I talk about knowing the top producers for any given region. You can walk around the shop, and for every region here, there's at least one of what we would consider a benchmark producer for that area. But then we also have the fun ones that are newer on the scene, new generation taking over, something new to the United States or new into Oregon. So we try and find the fun, lesser known things too. And again, because we don't have any real guidelines or rules, we get to curate the wines that we like. We get to curate wines that we think are interesting. We get to curate wines that we want to know more about. And we make the rules here. Mm-hmm. So we can do what we like. So between David and I and both of us preparing for upper level exams, we're really deep into the studying side, the theory side, but that allows us to come up with fun wines. And as we taste with reps, we get to use our years of experience in blind tasting and evaluating wines and making quality assessment calls. We get to use that to curate a wine shop that has a diverse selection of styles of wines, of regions represented, of different price points. And for every price point we have, yeah, we have people that come in and want something under $25. We have that. Yes, we have wine collectors that are coming in for unicorns mm-hmm. that you don't see in the wild that we have here. So we get to help everybody find the wine that they want, but knowing that whoever walks into the shop, we can find them a wine that is delicious and is a great wine for whatever price point they're looking for.
So I think you've partially answered this question, but I'm curious about when you mentioned you and David deep in study and you're focusing on things for like benchmark producers and things like that. Mm-hmm. How do you keep up on the cool new stuff? How do you find the things that are young, different, outside the box?
Well, it helps having the owner, Will, here, who does a lot of traveling, so we make a lot of those fun connections. Ultimately, David and I will be doing more traveling. Like, he's lucky right now. He's in the Republic of Georgia. I'm sure he's met great winemakers and had amazing wines there, and so who knows? Maybe we'll have some new Georgian wines coming into the shop soon. So as we get, you know, established here and get to start traveling ourselves, every time we go somewhere, we make connections. We try and meet winemakers. We talk to people. We drink the wines there. So every time that we do anything involving wine, it's getting tucked into our memory bank of, I remember when I was here or there and we had great wines. I met these producers. They have a great story to tell. They make great wines. And we get to bring all of that back to the shop every single time.
You mentioned story there, and obviously story is a big component of what you're learning, a big component of what we're doing. I'm always curious about sort of the stories that resonate for both you, you personally, and also for people you're selling wine to. How do you relate story, and what do you find people are most, yourself included, are most excited about when they're hearing a story of a wine producer?
It's always nice to know that there's some amount of legacy, like, oh, 5th, 6th, 7th, 20th, 19th generation winemakers, where you know that history is passed down. And it's hard not to have a nostalgic feeling for wines that you're like, great, I know that this person is doing wine because their father taught them how, or their mother, or their grandparents. And so you know that that was part of their upbringing. And so there's just that wholesome, like, family time spent together talking and drinking about wine and being in the cellar together and, you know, combining this love of both science and passion together and creating great wines. Like, there is something so rewarding of knowing that that tradition has carried on with, let's say, a particular family mm-hmm. where it's like, yeah, that sounds great. Like, I love to support that and keep this generation going. Mm-hmm. So that's a part of it. There's also the part that not only, you know, for me personally, but the wider market of wine consumers now has a greater recognition for conservation efforts. So sustainable practices, organic practices, biodynamic, beef friendly, live certified, salmon safe, you name it. There's so many of them to adhere to. So I think also having a part of that has been great for people to connect with as I'm talking about wines, but for me too, like, we have to say thank you to the earth that's giving us these great grapes, as well as the farmers that are doing their good work to get it into the winery and all the winemakers' efforts from there. So if there's that sustainability, that focus of, you know, we're trying to take care of our land, we want to make sure that we are doing the right thing as much as we can, then that, I think, resonates with people as well.
So let's talk a little bit about Oregon. And the first question I'll ask is sort of how Oregon fits in the shop here. How does Oregon fit in the greater world of wine? I guess we'll start there.
Well, Oregon is kind of a amazing and unique wine growing region. Considering you look back, let's say Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, those are our bread and butter here in Oregon. But they got their start in Burgundy, back in France. And you have hundreds of years of meticulous note-taking by monks in the area that had nothing better to do other than take notes about what they were growing in their gardens and in the vineyard. And I guess they prayed a little bit too, but that was secondary to the vines, I'm sure. But you have this huge, long history. And here in Oregon, we don't have that. Really, the Oregon wine industry kicked off in the 1960s. So very young in the grand scheme of winemaking in the world. But what we have here in Oregon is an influx of winemakers and vignerons that come from all over the world that already are bringing a level of knowledge. We have, you know, a lot more technology now for winemaking than way back in the day. And that has only benefited new regions like Oregon, where you have all these people that have gone to great viticultural schools that are bringing their collective knowledge. They've traveled the world, they've gone to these different regions, made wines with some of the greats in the industry, and they are bringing that back to Oregon. So yes, it's new, but we're starting at a higher point than some other areas have started. We've had some growth and learning curves along the way, and that's going to continue to happen. Speaking of, you know, planting different clones or finding just the right vineyard site or right aspect. And that's continuing to be a challenge as we have climate change playing a role in that as well. In addition to all of the comprehensive wine knowledge that's being brought to the area, there's still a really great community in the valley as well. People are happy to share that knowledge with each other. You look up any winemaker from Oregon and you can see the laundry list of other Oregon producers that they've worked with. There's almost not that one person that's like, hey, I'm new here and I'm making fantastic wine with no help from anybody. That doesn't happen. So it's really great to know that community exists here too. So rising tide floats all boat mentality. So that is great. And in addition to that, we have plenty of international investment now. Those winemakers from Burgundy, from Champagne are investing in Oregon. And that's continuing to highlight the region on a global scale. So there's just more and more attention being paid here about world-class wines that we're making for a young region. We also have like the development of newer appellations, AVAs. So Willamette Valley was the big general one, and now we're getting all these tiny little nested areas because people are taking the time to really get to know the particular terroirs of Oregon. So it's not just, great, we're doing another appellation because we can. It's, we're doing this appellation because we can feel the unique voice of this area, regardless of winemaking methods applied. Some obscure terroir, we'll admit, like too much oak will do that. You'd lose that sense of place. But we're lucky where Pinot Noir typically doesn't lean towards that. So we are able to use this primary grape of Pinot Noir and look through the kaleidoscope of terroirs that Oregon has to offer through the lens of that one grape.
So when you're shopping for the Oregon section of this shop specifically, what are you looking for on kind of a general scale? What are you looking for as representative of Oregon?
It depends on which AVA you're talking about. So different AVAs have different voices. So for what we keep in the store, we try and have a variety of appellations and different styles of Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir is not just like one thing, for example. It's a huge spectrum of things. So we try and keep variety included, different appellations, different producers that follow different winemaking protocols, just so we can highlight the diversity. It's not just the one Oregon Pinot Noir. There are so many to choose from. Then we also have the added benefit of being able to offer some really cool vintage depth. Yes, young Oregon Pinot Noir is delicious. I highly recommend everybody drink it. But also, we have the ability to age Oregon Pinot Noir too. The history exists in Burgundy, again, because homeland of Pinot Noir, they've been making wine there for quite a long time. But you have a history of, right, this vineyard will produce wines that can age for this long. Oregon being newer, we don't have the long history to prove and look back and be like, look, we have Pinot Noirs that can hang out for 30 years and still taste amazing. So it's a little bit fun to help people understand that Oregon can age and does age very well and very gracefully, and we get to include examples of that. The last event we had at the shop was an all Oregon Pinot Noir event, and we got to pour 1994 Pinot Noir from Oregon. And for the vast majority, almost everybody that was here at that event had never had an Oregon Pinot Noir that old. We thought its 30-year birthday was an okay time to open it.
That's awesome. So with that said, tell me about what you're foreseeing for the future of the Oregon wine industry, and as you're kind of thinking how it relates to both the education you do and to the shop, what are you excited about that's coming in the future?
I'm excited about the continued focus of Oregon wines on the global scale. So my study buddies, for instance, that are spread across the country are seeing more Oregon wines make it into their markets. It's no longer just the quantity producers that are being seen. It's the smaller quality producers. You know, it's fun for me when I have someone come into the shop who's visiting, let's say from New York, and they're like, I saw this wine at my wine shop. The sommelier recommended this wine and it was amazing. And it's like, I am amazed that it was in New York and that you found it. I'm so glad you did and that you fell in love with it, just like we do here. So we are fortunate enough, we can just take a quick little drive, go down to Willamette Valley, hang out on a weekend. But it's exciting for me to see how it's growing, and we see Oregon wines in more international markets, and you know, getting to talk more on the global scale of what Oregon has to offer.
And let's talk about the future for the shop a little bit. Obviously, you've been here a little while. You've already brought some things to it. What's coming next? What's happening now? What's on the horizon for Crew and Domain?
Oh, so many things. We have so many different avenues, and you know, dreams are cheap. So I would love to say that nothing is off the table at this point. We just had the distribution side of the wine business here take off, which has been amazing. We're getting to partner with importers and bring in wines that have not been seen in the Oregon market before. You can only find them here. Or if you buy from our distribution, you know, it came from here. So it's fun to be able to be exploring new producers from around the world and, you know, highlight them here and expose people to those new and fresh experiences that they have not had before. There are plenty of other things that are looming on the horizon. I'll tell you about later. But nothing is off the table. If we can dream it, we can make it happen and make it become reality. So
with the education side specifically, how do you see that growing and expanding?
Hopefully with a little more space, mm-hmm. because right now I'm a little limited in terms of class size, but with the amazing response we had with this first offering, we did a little like 6-class series, and you could buy them independently or as a whole. They filled up almost immediately, and we had only told our email list about it.
Wow.
So we didn't post anything on social media yet. It was just direct to those that are subscribed to our email. They got the first peek, and it was sold out very quickly. So ultimately, we'll be able to grow that. We'll have a bigger space to fit more people in at a time. And I'm sure that we're going to be doing more in-depth targeted classes. We'll have maybe parallel tracks running that are at different times, so that if one time doesn't work for someone's schedule, they could sign up for the other set of classes. Mm-hmm. So there's plenty of room for growth. I could expand on the industry side as well if I chose to get approved program provider status and could actually provide certifying classes for those in the industry as well. So there's that opportunity.
Outside of that, tell me a little bit about what you're looking ahead to in the future, professionally, personally, otherwise. What's coming on the horizon that you're excited about?
Well, ultimately, like I said, I'm going to stay in education. I'm going to be teaching. That's always going to be a part of what I do. So that's never going to change. I'm hopeful in the future I'm going to have a few more travel opportunities so that I can go to more wine regions than I have currently been to. And, you know, multiple visits. It's hard to get a full picture from anywhere you travel on one visit. So ideally in the future, as I keep on building classes and building my role here, is that I will be doing more travel.
And sort of last question for you, you mentioned obviously mentorship, big part of what you want to do. Tell me about advice you would give or have given to someone who wanted to join the wine industry? Obviously, there's a lot of different ways to join the wine industry, but kind of general advice. How would you suggest someone approach that?
It depends on the person, what their ultimate goals are in the industry. I think there are so many facets to the wine industry that you can find your little niche no matter what it is that your area of interest is. So whatever your superpower is, like, lean into that and go for that, because you could absolutely make a home for yourself in the wine industry. We have all types and all different kinds of roles, and that's fantastic. So yes, if you're interested in the wine industry, dive in, do it. My advice would be get a lot of different perspectives by doing different things, like I did. I worked for wineries and restaurants and distribution and retail. So the more diverse that you can bring your kind of background to, the better. And always be hungry for that growth of knowledge. Like, find ways to challenge yourself mentally to keep learning more. It's never an end destination. You shouldn't stagnate or be complacent with where you're at. Like, keep buying books, keep reading books. Don't just buy them and let them collect dust. Like, actually read them and keep doing that.
And keep tasting wine.
Always. And you always learn material better. If you're studying any given region, if you also have a glass of wine from that region, and it makes more sense. Like, oh, I understand why the wine is like this. Like, you read all the things about it, you should be drinking the wine with it too.
It's fantastic. All the questions that I have for you, anything I didn't ask that I should have, anything we didn't cover today that you'd like to cover?
I don't think so.
All right, excellent. Thank you so much for your time,
you.
Sharing your story with us, sharing this beautiful space with us once again, mm-hmm. and we'll go ahead and let you off the hook.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of the Oregon Wine History Archive podcast. And thank you to all our supporters, partners, donors, and interviewees who have helped make our project a success. Be sure to check out our website at OregonWineHistoryArchive.org for more interviews, photographs, wine labels, and more. And stay tuned for more interviews as we tell the story of Oregon wine. The Oregon Wine History Archive podcast is brought to you from the Oregon Wine History Archive at Linfield University, with a very special thank you to all the Linfield Archive students who have contributed to these oral history interviews over the years.